Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and today we have a very special episode. This is actually our 100th episode here on In the Drink. Yes. I remember it was 2 years ago. I was on Michael Harlan Turkle's show. I was a guest on the show. I had no idea, I had no dream that I would ever actually host a radio show myself. And we had such a great time. And I after the show, got to chatting with Jack, the producer, and they offered me a show. And I was very hesitant at first because I've never done this before. And it has been such a great experience. I've gotten to speak with some people in the industry that I really absolutely admire. It's such a joy to spend a half hour of my week with talking with our guests and sharing it with you. So thank you so much for those of you who've been listening. And I'm extremely excited about our show today. Today we have someone who is without a doubt an expert in all things Chinese food and in restaurants in general and operations of restaurants. He's been in the industry since the 1970s, and he operates really three of the most popular, most busy, highest quality, most amazing restaurants here in the city. It's Ed Schoenfeld from Red Farm. He has Red Farm in the West Village, right around the corner from Lartuzzi. Red Farm Uptown in the Upper West Side, and the newly opened Decoy. Ed, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Really, really excited to have you. I remember when you opened the first Red Farm, it was around the corner from Lartuzzi, and I went over and I introduced myself, and I had no clue who you were, the kind of experience you had. And I said, "Wow, Ed, it is." I just said, "Hi, my name is Joe. I have the restaurant around the corner. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the neighborhood. Congratulations, your restaurant looks it's beautiful. What an improvement on that space." And you said, "Yeah. I've done this before. I feel pretty confident in this one. I have the greatest Chinese chef around." And I was like, "Oh, this guy." A little confident in himself, and it turns out you were right. God, boy, is the food great at our farm.
Thanks so much. I own the restaurant and operate the restaurant, but more than being the proprietor, I am a fan of great Chinese cooking, and it's something I've been chasing after my whole life, and it's simply something that's a great passion of mine, and it's really exciting to have restaurants where I'm not only the operator, but a fan of our chef and the creativity and the just plain delicious work that he does.
Yeah, he is truly, truly talented. So tell us about how you got into the Chinese restaurant world. I'm sure this is a story you've told before. It's something that throughout the Jewish culture, we're all big fans. And I know Joe Campanelli, you might not think of my mom's side is very Jewish. And grew up eating Chinese food, my whole life. But how did you specifically get into professional?
Well, I have heard many Jewish Chinese jokes. Obviously, they've all come my way, and my story is that I started cooking as a kid with my grandmother on Friday afternoons when I was 11 years old. And I went to a New York City private school where we stayed in school till 5 o'clock every day. And on Fridays, we got off at 1 o'clock, and I would go to my grandmother's house. And when I was 11 years old, I already could work 4 or 5 crepe pans at once when she was making blintz wrappers. Five, 6 years later, when I was graduating from high school and starting college and kind of asking myself the question, what do I want to do with my life? I really kind of quickly came to the conclusion that I love food. I loved cooking. At the time, I thought maybe food writing would be a way to go. I got a job working for my local newspaper, the Brooklyn Heights Press. I wrote 75 columns for them. The column was entitled Gravy Stains. And I started cooking every day and teaching myself about cooking. And I started taking classes. And I took a class kind of on a whim mm-hmm. with a lady named Grace Chu, who was those days the doyen of Chinese cooking teachers in the United States. Her husband had been a famous diplomat, and her husband had been China's ambassador to Moscow. And Grace ran in the 1940s the Chinese embassy in Moscow and, you know, fed people like Stalin. She ran a staff. When she got to New York, you know, 20 years later, and her husband had passed away and she wanted to make a life for herself, she decided to teach Chinese cooking. She knew a great deal about Chinese food and culture, but not so much about the secret recipes of chefs. She wasn't the world's best cook. But I learned a great deal from her, and the difference between what she did and what a really fine professional chef did really sparked my curiosity. And I started setting up Chinese banquets for a hobby. And unbeknownst to me, our immigration laws had just changed. And until the late 60s, Chinese were not allowed to come to the United States except on a tourist visa. Mm-hmm. But in the late 60s, that changed, and it sparked an immigration of fairly wealthy Chinese and a group of chefs, some of whom really were some of the best chefs of their generation and were trained to cook in China before the Communist Revolution. China went communist on October 1st, 1949. So in 1970, one of these chefs in 1949 was 35 or 40. This is 20 years later. These chefs were 55 or 60. There was a group of them who landed in New York City. I started setting up banquets as a hobby. And I set up, a couple hundred banquets in the course of maybe 18 months or 2 years. And when I repeatedly went back to the same chefs and asked them to cook for me, they kind of took me under their wing and started teaching me. And I realized early on that one of the chefs who was cooking for me when he wasn't cooking for me was cooking for David Rockefeller or for I.M. Pei. And indeed, this group of chefs I'd fallen in with were some of the great chefs of the 20th century.
So was this your first for-profit food service business, setting up banquets with great Chinese chefs?
That was a hobby. It wasn't really? For profit.
Wow.
But what it did lead to was a relationship with a restaurateur who was named David Kay, and we call it K-E-H was really his name. And I think that along with just one or two other individuals, he was responsible for introducing authentic regional Chinese cooking, and specifically Sichuan cooking, into the United States. I asked David one day if he were ever going to open a I suggested if he were ever going to open a fancy Midtown Chinese mm-hmm. restaurant and wanted to hire me as his assistant, you know, a white guy, that might be fun. And sure enough, 4 or 5 months later, he called me up, told me he'd signed a lease on 3rd Avenue and 62nd Street. He offered me a job as his assistant. We spent 6 months setting up this new business. And because I was the only Caucasian person there and I was a, you know, fast-talking Jewish guy from New York City, he made me the host of the restaurant. He dressed me in a blue polyester tuxedo with a ruffled blue shirt and
blue
bow tie.
I would have loved to have seen that.
Someone just asked me if I had a picture from that, and unfortunately I don't. And I had never worked in a restaurant before. I'd been a New York City private school kid. I, you know, expected to become a doctor or a lawyer or an Indian chief or something, and my parents expected that as well. And I ended up dropping out of NYU, where I had a full scholarship, gave up my scholarship, and went to work with David. And because I was the English-speaking person, they put me at the front door of the restaurant. It was a restaurant that was called Uncle Tai's Hunan Yuan. It was a Hunan-style Chinese restaurant. It was one of the first two Hunan restaurants to open in the world outside of China. And we opened on January 7th, 1973. You were not close to being born yet. And 2 weeks after we opened, we got a review from the New York Times, and we got a 4-star review.
Wow.
So I found myself in my very early 20s running the dining room of one of the hottest restaurants in the country.
How many 4-star New York Times Chinese restaurants have there been since then?
I think that there haven't been any.
I think there haven't been any.
Right. there, in my lifetime that I recollect, the Shumley restaurants, when they were young in the 60s and early 70s, were really the first Chinese restaurants in New York City market to get a 4-star review. And the first restaurant that did that got a review from Craig Claiborne. And it's been long gone. It was called the Shumley Dynasty. It was at 48th and 2nd. They spun off another restaurant called Shumley Palace, which still exists on 55th Street. And then yet a third restaurant, which I actually set up and opened, which was the Shumley across from Lincoln Center, which opened in 1980. So we're, you know, this is a long time ago. And, you know, it's an interesting idea that no Chinese restaurants have merited a 4-star review in 40 years. But, you know, there's a reason for it. And a lot actually has to do with the immigration that I mentioned and the communist revolution and the fact that in China, once 1949 came around, Chinese chefs, really the top ones who typically worked for patrons, they really weren't able to practice their craft. And a group of them left the country. There was kind of a diaspora of them. And when they could, a group of them came here. That's how I got my education. And, you know, I'm very aware of the fact that I was exposed as quite a young man to a level of Chinese cooking that was very rarefied, that few professional chefs in China at that point could experience, because it was no longer permitted to cook that way or to eat that way, maybe on the very highest level. Maybe, you know, Mao Zedong or Zhou Enlai or the premiers of China had really great chefs who were still allowed to cook luxurious food. But by and large, you know, until the Cultural Revolution wound down and small amounts of capitalism started creeping into the society, there weren't restaurants as we knew them. They're not, certainly not fine restaurants. And it resulted in kind of a dumbing down of the cuisine. Certainly that happened here. Great chefs died off in the 70s, and they didn't really have students that could pass on their secrets to, and certainly not in a systematic way. Now things have changed completely, and, you know, there's a lot of disposable income in China, and when people have that kind of income, one of the first things they spend it on is on restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, so, for instance, we're always looking to find talented chefs to come work for us. And it's not hard to find chefs, but to find really talented ones here, the labor pool's kind of thin. It used to be that chefs would like coming here. They make a lot more money and send it home.
Yep.
Now they can make more money by staying in China and staying close to their families. Sense. So it makes the you know, the whole dynamics of who the best Chinese chefs are, it really changes.
And even for a period of time in the restaurant industry in America, if you wanted to earn your chops, you worked at a busy restaurant in New York City, right? Maybe San Francisco, but really you worked in New York City.
Sure, there's nothing like learning from a great chef.
And now you can have a great chef in so many different cities. There's so many different foodie cities with outstanding restaurants. You kind of don't have to come to New York anymore.
Interest in food has been gigantic change over my lifetime. And as a young person in my 20s, starting off in a 4-star restaurant, I kind of fantasized about what it would be like to have other people like me who had a similar passion and being friends with them. And it was hard to identify those people. There weren't so many of them. And now the industry's just exploded. You know, chefs are big stars. They're like movie stars. And if you're a proprietor of a restaurant, you get, that's, you know, like Red Farm, that's very popular and very successful. And
I'm a fan. Yeah.
You know, where when the customers leave, we don't worry about getting press. We love getting press. But what we worry about is giving our customers a really good experience, giving them delicious food, giving them knowing hospitality. And that's what, you know, builds legs and keeps our business strong for a long period of time.
Okay, as someone who is such an expert on Chinese foodways and culture and history, Red Farm is not a direct representation or an authentic representation in any way of China. How do you kind of take those to your side where you know so much about Chinese culture and translate that to something that, I mean, is admittedly everyone loves it. It's super, super popular. And where did that kind of crossover.
Well, I think you have to go back to the word authenticity, and you need to find the context for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're kind of proud of the fact that we're not focused on being authentic. We're focused on being delicious, and in our case, very, very finely crafted. And the skill set that we work with in our restaurant is clearly classical Chinese cooking, but it's moved to a little bit more modern place, something that I think was lacking in the Chinese food world for a really long time, still is, but it's something that's changing now. And so we're concerned about taking our ingredients, working with really good ingredients, mm-hmm. fresher, more farm-to-table things when they're available. You know, we are a Chinese restaurant, so some of the foods that we work with, you know, grow in rice paddies, and we don't have too many local rice paddies around here. So we can't always be locavore, but we certainly are seasonal. But it's really about having a very high level of craft. So, for instance, our head chef, Joe Ng, is a dim sum chef by training. And his skill set is...
Wait, so just to interrupt you, I remember when the first time we met, you told me that Joe had 1,000 dumplings in his repertoire.
Joe has about 1,000 dumplings in his repertoire.
Really?
It really is. You know, what's amazing is that I actually have a sense of how deep that goes, and that he concentrates in maybe 15 different forms in our restaurant, maybe 20. And, you know, the other 880 he has in his hip pocket. And he kind of breaks them out when he feels like it. But, you know, he makes 100, for instance, he makes 100 different dumplings that are shaped like 100 different animals. And in our restaurant, we have dumplings that look like stingrays.
Yep.
They're filled with duck and vegetables, and they have a little crab pincer as a tail.
Pac-Man.
We have our Pac-Man dumplings. You know, I don't know if we should call the ghosts animals, but they're certainly personifications of something. And, you know, what really happened in the opening of Red Farm is that we started doing tastings, and we had the idea of using fresher ingredients and being a farm-to-table kind of Chinese restaurant. And when Joe started randomly cooking a lot of things, he said to me, you know, I really want to bring out dishes that when Chinese people are sitting there and the waiter's carrying the dish by them, maybe to some other table, that the Asian customer who's there takes a look at that dish and says, what's that? You know, it's like they're excited to see that. Yeah. You know, since I've been involved in the business, I'll go into any kind of restaurant and kind of strut around the dining room and look maybe a little too hard at what everyone's eating. It's a great way to find out about, you know, what's going on. And in our restaurants, where we have a lot of communal seating, and sometimes it's a little uncomfortable if you put a party of twos sitting opposite one another, and they have parties on either side of them, then they sit down and they suddenly see a dish come to someone not far from them at the communal table, and it's a spring roll that's shaped to look like a palm tree or a flower, and they go, excuse me, what's that? And it starts a dialogue, and it turns the
experience. There's a playfulness to the food, and it makes you like it even before you taste it. You're like,
right.
This is enjoyable already.
Right. It looks fun, and then it you know, if it only looked cool but didn't taste great, it would be pretty pretentious. But the fact that it looks really terrific and tastes really good, it kind of goes to the spirit of the restaurant. So we try to be playful in the kind of hospitality we give our guests. And in the foods that we put on the table, though, I mean, our first idea is to make food that's delicious and then that, you know, has a nice presentation. And it's based on Chinese cooking, but we're not reluctant. You know, when we make Pac-Man dumplings, we have a Pac-Man and we have the ghost of the actual dumplings. The Pac-Man is
a third, right?
It's actually a sweet potato. A big round 4-inch sweet potato disc. And dipped in a tempura batter, and they cut a little pie-shaped wedge out of it for the mouth, and they put a little eye in it. Well, we want Pac-Man to stand up straight, and, you know, we actually put some guacamole on the end of the plates, really there to hold the sweet potato face, but also because it goes really well when you have that crunchy tempura batter, you can dip it in the guacamole, and it tastes good. It's obviously not authentic, but you know, it's sensible.
First time I had that brought me back to our first days at Del Anima, And Gabe put avocado bruschetta on. Now you see avocado toast all over. It's very popular. And I was like, Gabe, what? Avocado bruschetta at Dall'Anima? And that really started this whole dialogue about it's delicious, it makes sense, and why not? All right, we're going to take a quick break, and it wouldn't be in the drink if we didn't ask you some questions about drinks. So we'll do that at the second half of the program. We'll take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
All right, and we're back on In the Drink with Ed Schoenfeld from Red Farm and Decoy. Ed, as it wouldn't be in the drink if I didn't ask you some drink related questions. We've had quite a few people on the show who either work in Chinese restaurants or are big Riesling fans, and it has become just de rigueur, like, to have Chinese food with Riesling, especially if you're a wine person. I did it myself over the weekend. I had a delicious Karthauserhof 2004. Delicious, delicious with some Chinese food. When did this start? Has this, in your history of Chinese restaurants in New York, did people always want to drink Riesling with Chinese food?
Well, I you know, Chinese food has a certain amount of sugar in it. And not always, but very, very often. And you know, we're in the food and beverage business, so we always have wanted to sell beverages, and we make more money on our beverages. And you know, from the beginning, I remember a product that I bet you don't remember, but it was called Wan Fu, and it was
marketing
ploy by one of the big winemakers. I don't remember who, to put a Chenin Blanc in a bottle, calling it Wan Fu, designed for Chinese restaurants, and it gave them something that was, you know, not bone dry, that was herbaceous, that was grassy, that could hold up to, you know, Chinese food. And certainly Rieslings, whether it's one with a drier finish or, you know, German Riesling that's fruity and more like an Auslese or something that would go well, like with foie gras or, you know, the way Sauternes would. I mean, those things work with our flavors. And so we have a number of different things like that available in our restaurants. And, you know, we're doing the New York Food and Wine Festival. And, you know, things we have picked out for that are, an Alsatian Pinot Gris.
I am coming to your New York Food and Wine Festival. It's a dumpling and Riesling.
Right, it's called Dim Sommelier this year.
Yes, you with Josh Wesson.
Yes, Josh does all our wine, and he and I are real buddies.
He's a friend of the show. He's been on the show, a good friend of mine. How did that friendship come about, you and Josh?
You know, I think we don't remember. Like, we've just known each other for probably 25 or 30 years. And I've always been really fond of Josh. And you know, I have a reputation in the industry for being a bit of a teetotaler. So if you ask me what I want to be drinking, it's going to be fresh pressed watermelon juice, or we have this great white peach flavor that comes from Japan that we mix with some jasmine tea. But so I've often just referred to Josh and kind of let him have fun with our food and with his wine selections. And you know, we have things like, you know, Lambruscos that are frizzante that, you know, go really well, and you know, different things. Right now, everything's so exploded in terms of what's available there. I mean,
and you're kind of taking it to another level with your bar program at Decoy.
Well, you know, Decoy's been about for us about trying to build a bar business together with a Peking duck restaurant, and we have a group of bartenders there that are, you know, kind of the type of bartender you'd see in one of the mixology joints that have, you know, proliferated throughout our industry around the country. And we do everything fresh. We make my chef actually complains about the large volume of fresh fruit and vegetable that we use that he thinks is put on his food cost, because we're making fresh juices every day, and just, you know, extractions and fresh ginger ale. And
I can relate to that issue. Right. Yeah.
So
you're even doing a duck fat washed cocktail.
Yeah, we call it sitting down to dinner. And we take the fat that we are rendering off of our Peking ducks, and we have a special kind of custom-made bespoke duck oven where the ducks hang down. There's a round little bar, and we hook them off that bar, and then there's a central heat source, and it comes up along the side of the ducks, and it enables them to get particularly crispy. We take that duck fat, we mix it with bourbon. They hang out together for a couple of days. We chill the mixture. The fat rises to the top. We take it away, and we're left with this bourbon that has, you know, that little je ne sais quoi, that little extra whole flavor component to it. And then we mix it with, you know, some sweet and tart, some citrus juice, and we shake it up, and we put a little egg white in, and we get a real foamy head. And then we have a little stencil of a duck decoy, and we spray red wine on the white foam, and it comes to the table with, you know, this duck decoy on it.
That's almost a it's like a New York sour duck version 2.0.
You know, it actually people love it. It goes well with our food.
Yeah, and that sounds awesome.
You know, we have another cocktail that's spicy, and that comes with a cover, and we put smoke in there. And when you uncover it, the smoke, you get the scent of smoke coming out. And you know, some of the playfulness that we did in our food in Red Farm, we've done with our alcohol program in Decoy, and also with our food program down there. And you know, we keep the bar open till 2 a.m. We actually have snacks available.
When you first opened, it was just open. The open time was later as well. Is that still going on? What are the hours of Decoy?
Well, Decoy opens at 5.
Okay.
And it stays open until 1:45. We have a 2 o'clock license. So the way things work in New York City now is when you go for a liquor license, the community board wants you to close early, and they say they try to, you know, give you a 10 o'clock license or a 12 o'clock license. Some of us have 4 a.m. licenses in locations, but these days they're not so great. And so we have a 2 o'clock license.
That's pretty strong. And they ask you, are you going to have a DJ and a dance floor and all
these? Yeah, we don't have room for that. So.
Well, we were planning on having a DJ and a dance floor, but we'll give those two things up if you let us stay open till 2.
You know, we have a stereo system that would be perfect for that, actually. It's you know, a little on the overbuilt side, but, you know, we have people who have parties there and they want to have some music, and, you know, it works really well.
So just this year, China became the largest consumer of red wine in the world, surpassed Italy and surpassed France, which were prior the two largest consumers. Has Josh ever tried to put a Chinese wine? And I should say also, most of the wine that they're consuming is domestically produced. Certainly at the very high end, that's mostly imported, but it's over 80% of the wine is domestically produced. I've never had a Chinese wine. I I wouldn't imagine that there's tons of very high quality Chinese wines out there.
I see tons of alcoholic beverages from Japan.
Yes,
and we sell some good quality sakes, but I haven't seen any. No one's been trying to sell us a wine that's made in China. But I'm very aware of the fact that especially high-end Chinese customers are very interested in drinking red wine. And in recent years, traveling around Beijing or Shanghai or other cities in China, and you certainly see that in evidence.
Yeah, and something that I've always noticed on your list, and maybe this has changed since I've been there last, but is that the wine list kind of skews towards the less expensive, mostly very less. I mean, I imagine you have, especially in the West Village and Upper West Side, and these high-end customers coming in who could spend lots and lots of money on wine. But has that been a conscious decision to kind of keep everything below?
It has been. We want our restaurant to be very approachable. And it's that approachability is a precept that we have throughout our business. When you think about the popularity of our restaurant, which is just fantastic from my perspective, one of the things that I am very aware of is how our center of the plate proteins are things that are very easy. Chinese food is known for using every part of the animal and a lot of esoteric things, and duck webs and goose intestines and fish maws. But when you come into Red Farm, we are excellent cooks, but we're not trying to make goose intestines excellent. We're about very approachable, understandable things. Like, we have a great steak. We're really good at marinating and grilling food. And we serve things like, striped bass and sea bass and salmon and shrimp and noodles and dumplings and pork chops. Things that people are not put off by. But then we do it with a visual, often a humorous, whimsical twist. Mm-hmm. And the real twist is how delicious the stuff ends up being. So, our wine kind of goes along with that. Our wine is approachable. It's appropriate. Josh is, Josh had his own retail businesses where it was about him selecting things that were modestly priced.
Yeah, I think at Bestsellers, everything was under $15 or $25.
I think it depends what year you were talking. But yes. Yeah, someplace in that world. And, we do have, we've gone through a few changes. We have customers who come in and would like to have something special, which, it could still be inexpensive and special, but often, they want, you have the guest who wants to spend money. And we do now have, some bottles like that hang out. Okay. And if you ask us for a list of them, we'll produce another list.
I think that's a good
idea. Yeah, I like it when our customers can spend more money, because especially they want to. Yeah. It's not like you're forcing them to do that.
Now, I have to ask about this. My girlfriend Alyssa and I recently saw the Tribeca Film Festival premiere of The Search for General Tso.
Oh yeah,
and
cool.
We're as I said before, we're big fans of Red Farm, and she has even instilled in me more of a love of Chinese food in the last few years. But what was that experience like going through that documentary? You're kind of tapped as this Chinese food expert that you are, and you're featured very prominently in the film.
It came about in a very backwards and funny way. The filmmaker did a video of me about 3 years ago for the New York Times, when the New York Times was reviewing Red Farm. And it was a much more extensive interview than ended up being on the Times website. Mm-hmm. He actually used that footage and included it in the movie, The Search for General Tso. And I wasn't even aware of it. And I got an email one day, remember me? I did this video with you 2.5 years ago. Well, how would you feel about being a prominent character in this movie? And in fact, you're already the prominent character in the movie, and the movie's about to debut. And I didn't quite – it took me actually a few weeks to quite get the context and understand – that, this guy taped me for the New York Times, had all this extra footage, and included in this movie. That being said, you know, I showed up and I walked on the red carpet at the Tribeca Film Festival, and I really had a lot of fun with it. And, you know, I'm sorry it didn't make it into general release. I hope that it does still. I think they've been looking to do that with it.
Wow, I wasn't aware that it didn't, but really great film, just super informative. And I think that everyone has had General Tso's chicken. You know, anyone who eats chicken.
Well, the amazing thing about the whole story of General Tso's chicken is that the restaurant that I referred to earlier in our conversation, mm-hmm. that I opened in 1973, Uncle Tai's Hunan Yuan, was actually a restaurant that came about because David Kay, the gentleman I worked with, had opened some Sichuan restaurants. Suddenly that exploded, and he wanted to go back to Taiwan and look for a new concept or a new regional cuisine. And another restaurateur, a chef named T.T. Wang, who was the founder of the Shum Lee restaurants, had the same thought. And in 1972, each of these restaurateurs, who were rivals, not knowing what the other was doing, each went back to China, to Taiwan, to Taipei, and look for a restaurant to copy and bring to New York. They each found the same restaurant, and they each searched for chefs from who had worked in this restaurant who knew those recipes. They each brought over chefs, and they each opened restaurants that had virtually the same menu, and each of the restaurants got 4 stars, and they had nothing to do with each other, except that they were both copying the same restaurant. Now, to complete the circle here, the restaurant that they copied was a restaurant called Peng Yuan. Peng was the name of the chef who owned it. Mm-hmm. Yuan means garden. And Chef Peng learned to cook in China in the 1940s because he was the chef to the governor of Hunan province, who was a famous gourmet. And when the revolution came about, Chef Peng went to Taiwan, and after a few years, he got some money together and opened a restaurant featuring the banquet-style dishes that they had prepared for the governor in Hunan province, who was a famous gourmet. Well, this restaurant, and we're talking about the 50s, mm-hmm. this restaurant became one of the hottest restaurants in the community, and it was Chef Peng who first introduced General Tso's chicken. And what's interesting is that when Chef T.T. Wang from Shum Lee and when David Kay, the restaurateur that I worked for, went back in 1972 to Taipei to find a restaurant to copy, and they found Chef Peng's restaurants, they each brought back General Tso's chicken and put it on the menu. And the chefs of each of the two New York restaurants interpreted it in different ways. And it was actually Chef Wang, T.T. Wang from Shum Lee, who took this dish of chunks of kind of crispy dark meat in a spicy brown sauce and took the flavor profile from a tart sauce to a sweet tart sauce, which is actually the way the dish is made, you know, all over the industry now. And so when you're talking about the search for General Tso's chicken, even though there was a General Tso who lived in the 1800s, as they said in the movie, I don't think he was known for liking chicken. You know, it was just a name that they took, and they assigned it to this dish. And it's really the version that Chef Wang evolved here in the United States that became wildly popular. And Chef Peng and his restaurant that opened in 1954 or 53, mm-hmm. I have the dates off for possibly. The amazing thing about
I don't think anyone's going to call you out on that.
Well, but Chef Peng is still alive.
Amazing.
He's about 100 years old, and his restaurant is still open. And his kid, Shorty, you know, his son, runs, they have a couple of restaurants in Taiwan, and the son is now well into his 70s. And I was lucky enough to go to the restaurant not so long ago, about 3 years ago. I was in Taipei, and I went to the restaurant that was kind of the seminal restaurant that helped evolve a bunch of dishes. One of the other dishes that came out of that restaurant was crispy orange beef, which is also we're talking about dishes that over the last group of years in the United States have sold billions of dollars.
The amazing part about the story is really once those dishes got to the U.S., how they just became pervasive in such a short amount of time, in a decade or so, right? It went from being unknown, not even invented dishes on some very nice restaurant menus to
becoming icons. Yeah.
To becoming icons. It's crazy. Now, I have to ask you one last question because we're already way over time, but just where do you like to eat Chinese food in New York City other than Red Farm? I need to know.
Well, you know, I like to go to a little Cantonese dinner restaurant in Brooklyn Chinatown called Lucky Eight.
Lucky Eight. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, taking notes.
And, you know, the Nanxing Bun House on Prince Street in Flushing has good soup dumplings. Mm-hmm. Some of the big Cantonese dim sum restaurants in Flushing are pretty good. You know, unfortunately,
yeah,
we have
Cantonese, and Liz always, even just this morning, was going on. She's like, ah, that dim sum at Chinatown Brasserie, which you were a part of, was really some of the best dim sum that she's ever had. And she spent time in Hong Kong. And
it is some of the best dim sum. I mean, Joe is a chef there. Joe Eng, my partner in Red Farm, and he's a superb chef. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And he's, you know, pretty creative. We took him actually to the Basque region in Spain, and he got a chance to eat the food of, you know, Adria and some of the more modern molecular chefs. And I think it was very inspiring for him. He was creative already, but it showed him new directions. And he started things like spherification and, you know, sous vide cooking and, you know, a whole more modern approach to food.
All right. That's going to be our next show. We're going to talk about modern approach. We're already way over, but Ed, thank you so much. It's I'm so happy that you're the 100th show. Really, I'm such a big fan of the
restaurant.
Thanks
restaurants. For inviting me. It was fun to be here.
And I want to give a big shout out, a big thanks to Aaron, and Jack and Alex Moskowitz, I hope you're listening, and Jory Morales, who just brought us some rosé champagne to celebrate. Thank you, Jory, and especially thanks to all of you for listening. This has been it's been a fantastic 100 episodes. I hope that we get to do 100 more. Thanks again. This has been our 100th episode of In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.